What Frank didn't mention was that Margaret had been unfaithful before. Frank was looking closer at the bed, squinting at the young woman inside it. "Rebecca," I said, "you told us the problems in their marriage went back long before you were on the scene. Care to elaborate?" She glanced from her husband to the woman in the bed.
"Frank never thought Lizzie was his."
"The dates didn't match up," Frank said, distractedly, still standing in the debris of the heart monitor. "I would have been in active deployment when Maggie got pregnant." "Okay," said Sloane, staring at Esther. "She's Wick's progeny. Does that mean that he didn't kill the Moors, or that he did? Where was she? Where's she been all this time?"
"I ran away," said Esther. "I found out Frank wasn't my real dad, that Martin was. Then I thought he'd killed them all. I didn't have anyone."
Kevin Blake was undoing the top buttons of his shirt. "When did you find out Frank wasn't your real dad?" said Sloane.
"All the bullying and threats and bullshit," she said, looking at Frank. "All the violence.
You do realize she was glad to tell me."
"You're wrong about one thing," he said. Some power had left his body, and his voice had weakened with it. "I was your real dad, and I still am, whatever you might think, whatever the DNA might say. I raised you for 12 years, loved you for 12 years. I've loved you every day since."
He took 2 halting steps towards the bed. Esther, Lizzie Moore, looked at him like he was poison.
"Don't you get it? DNA doesn't mean shit. You stopped being my dad the day you raised a hand to her. You don't get to decide, Frank. I do. I say that little girl you raised still alive. My brother and sister are still alive, my mum. You're the only one who fucking died because we decided it."
I went to the bed, trying to stand between them. "Why don't you tell us what happened that night?"
"I can tell you Martin Wick didn't do it," she said. "He was with me. It was the first time we'd ever met. To be honest, I didn't even like him. He tried to dress up, brush back his hair and stuff, but he couldn't help looking like a loser next to Frank. He took me to a little chef. We had an awkward fry-up and he took us home."
She looked about the room.
"Problem was, his van broke down on the way. We were late. It was dark, and as much as we knocked, no one answered. Martin didn't know what to do, so I stayed with him at his hotel. He snuck me in so there wouldn't be any questions, and when we went back in the morning..."
"What happened then?"
"We got there really early," she said. "He knocked, but there was still no answer. We could see inside a bit now because it was light, and when he looked through a window, he almost fell over. He told me to wait and went round the back. I heard glass break and started to get scared. I wasn't tall enough to see what he'd seen through the window, so I just waited. It felt like I waited forever."
She swallowed, wiped her eyes.
"Then I went round the back and followed him through the kitchen window. He'd cut himself climbing through, but I followed him anyway. I walked into the hall and..."
We all looked between each other.
"And I could see blood everywhere. And there was this pile of dirty clothes at the bottom of the stairs. Somehow, there was a face attached to them. And somehow it was my mum's. I just stood there, with my back to the front door, looking at her. I couldn't remember how to get out. I couldn't even remember how to breathe. Then Martin came down the stairs. He was covered in blood. Covered in it. And I realized I couldn't hear Arthur or Mary. He said something. Something like, 'They're all dead.' And I started to scream. He tried to hug me and I hit him. Now I know he was as scared as I was. But then I just thought he'd broken in and killed them. I called him a psycho. Got the door open and ran."
"Where did you go?"
asked Naomi.
Esther shook her head like she couldn't remember.
"School, I think. I slept in the game shed that first night.
I'd never been so tired in my life. When I woke up and walked into town, Mardin was in all the papers. The sleepwalker, they called him. He'd been arrested. They said he was guilty. And as far as I knew, I'd been standing on the driveway while he did it. Some of the papers even said I was dead.
She put her hand to her breastbone, pressing hard.
I wondered if I was. It was one of the great disappointments of my life to realize I was still breathing.
Lizzie, said Frank, after all that blood and death and fear, do you know what the worst part was? Do you know what really fucking scared me?
Frank shook his head.
That they'd send me to live with you.
All the air seemed to go out of him.
Whoever took a knife and cut them up?
Well, at least he made it quick.
Real cruelty's killing someone slowly, over years, with words and insults and threats and lies. I'll never hate my mother's killer like I fucking hate you, Frank. You're the reason I ran away that day. You're the reason I've run away every day since.
Her voice broke.
I lived rough. I fell in with a girl who was doing a charity scam with her mar. They looked after me. They were travellers, and it wasn't long after we ended up in Ireland. I fucked for drugs and money, Frank. I want you to know that. At first, Esther was my whore name, but after a while it just felt like who I was all that time.
What made you come back? Asked Naomi.
The paper said Mardin was dying, and that brought it all up again. Then I found a copy of his book in a charity shop, she said,
nodding at Blake. He was leaning into the wall now, like it was the only thing keeping him upright.
It was hard to read, and it was the first time I'd let myself think about what happened. He said the forensics proved they'd all died on Friday night, and that's when I realized I was Martin's alibi. He'd been with me that entire time.
Raising questions about how he wrote, read, and signed a 25-page confession, I said, turning to Kevin Blake. Especially as an illiterate man.
I'd rather not discuss it, he said, one hand on his chest.
Dad said they kept him away for 3 or 4 days. Kept telling him what he'd done, over and over again, until he had it down pat. Then they pressed records and transcribed it. They said he could sleep if he signed all 25 pages. He was already in shock when they got their hands on him.
Who?
Said Blake, leaning into the wall. There were tears in his eyes.
I mean, if it wasn't him, then who?
That was never our question to answer, I said. It was yours. You might have meant well, putting a killer behind bars and making sure he stayed there, but you fitted up the wrong man, Kev. All it took was planting the murder weapon in his hotel room and coaching him through his confession. Your book was the cherry on top. Blake looked from face to face, doubling up as he did so. Then Esther turned up 12 years later, a cast-iron alibi for Martin Wick. Proof that you'd built everything, your case, your book, your life, on lies. I kept wondering how anyone could get close enough to shake hands with Rennick and then stab him. I was thinking affairs, bribes.
He recognized me, said Blake. Said you're the man who caught Martin Wick. Let me shake your hand.
Then you stabbed him in the neck. Blake swallowed 3 times in a row, gulping air.
I hate what happened to him, he said. Hate it. But I haven't got long. When you get to the shit end of the stick, you start wondering what you stack up to. I didn't want to die discredited. A fucking joke. And Sutty,
he shook his head.
Whatever. He was no cop. And neither are you. It's no surprise you're his fucking protege.
I didn't set anyone on fire, Kev.
I told you the first time we met, he said, clawing at his chest. For someone, that fire was the only possible course of action. Well, that someone just happened to be me.
I had no choice. I was in and out in 5 minutes.
He gulped again and then slid down the wall, landing in a heap on the floor. Chapter 5. Naomi, Esther and I were on the roof of St. Mary's Hospital, staring down at the sodium-lit car park. Frank Moore had been arrested and Kevin Blake was in intensive care, having suffered a massive heart attack. Rebecca Moore, bone white from the evening's revelations, had been taken home in a squad car, and Charlie Sloan had torn off to write his exclusive. Once the excitement was over, Esther pleaded for us to take her outside to get some air. I agreed, leading us up the stairwell where we'd first brushed past each other, this time with Naomi in tow. It had been a long night, but we were all wide awake with the exhilaration of answers, and we were passing the bottle of Johnny Walker between us as dawn broke. There was still one question, hanging over everything. "Who killed them?" said Esther, giving voice to it, the story of her life. We were all leaning against the wall, looking over the edge. "I don't know," I said. "Blake only became involved with Wick's arrest, we're sure of that. Both he and Frank have alibis, and I'm convinced Frank's certainty about Martin's guilt was genuine. He thought having him attacked inside Strangeways for all those years was justified because he'd killed his family." I glanced at Esther. "For a minute, I thought about you. I was a kid. Hard to believe I ever was one now." As I looked at her, I realized how young she must still be. 24 or 5 at the most. She'd started to shiver, although it wasn't cold, and I wondered how far this might go towards getting her clean.
"What changed your mind?" she said.
"You're Martin's alibi. We can't talk to him now. But you're so certain of his innocence. I believe you."
"I can't tell if it's the subject or the weather," she said. "But I'm fucking freezing."
She was wearing 3 double-wrapped nightgowns, but had declined my long coat on fashion grounds.
"A smoke might get the blood flowing."
I looked at Naomi. She was wrapped up in her dark green parka and shrugged at me from its depths. It had been the first time I'd been myself, my best self, since we met, and I wanted her to like me. I hoped that she did. "I'll go," I said, taking the bottle. "This probably isn't the day for going cold turkey."
"I'll quit tomorrow," said Esther.
I nodded and walked the 25 feet or so towards the doorway, weaving between an enormous bank of air conditioning units. When I reached the door, I paused to look back. Esther and Naomi seemed deep in conversation, their backs to me. Just a parka jacket and a triple-wrapped nightgown. I raised the bottle for a drink and felt an explosion of pain in my jaw. A moment later, it slammed to the ground, and I put my hands out to break the fall a second too late. I tried to push myself up, but was flattened by another blow to the head. I could taste thick, rich blood oozing from my mouth, and felt its warmth flooding out and down my chin. I could see 2 boots in front of me. I looked up and saw a flash of Louisa Yankovsky for a second, before she brought the gun butt down on my head for a 3rd, 4th, 5th blow. When I wrenched myself up off the ground again, I didn't know how much time had passed. My vision was blurred, and I could feel one eye swelling shut. I saw Louisa approaching Naomi from behind. My partner was still leaning against the wall, looking over the edge, and I tried to call out a warning, but nothing came. Louisa raised her pistol, and I started to move, feeling my way along an air conditioning unit to stay upright. Naomi must have heard me, because she'd begun to turn around when the gun went off. The muzzle flash blasted her hood back, and she fell, dead, to the ground. Yankovsky turned and saw me. I backed into the stairwell, turning, belting down the staircase, and the gunfire went off again. As soon as I was down the first flight, I realized I should have hidden behind the door. I should have let Yankovsky pass me and attack her from behind. But all I could think of was running.
I tripped at the top of the next flight and went head first, rolling down and landing in a painful heap at the bottom. The lower half of my jaw felt like it had come loose from my body, and I tried to reach up for a banister, seeing the blood drain out of my mouth. I heard footsteps descending, and turned towards them, seeing double, triple, overlapping images. Louisa turned the corner, drawing her pistol.
"I had no choice," she said. "Without Esther, it's just a phone that called mine. It's nothing."
She licked her lips.
"But I really didn't want this."
She leveled the gun, and I heard a deafening bang. When I opened my eyes, I saw blood splattered against the wall, and Louisa sprawled, dead on the floor. I turned to see a large man in a black balaclava on the stairwell beneath me. He cocked his head, almost comically, then tapped his own pistol against his temple, as if warning me to be more careful in future. I got to my knees and started towards him, but he turned to leave. I made it two or three steps more before blacking out. Part 8. Everything Must Go. Chapter 1. I came awake as an 8-year-old boy in the messy back seat of a family car. We'd moved around a lot in the year before my sister and I were taken into care, often spending nights parked in laybys or motorway service stations. Our mother drove all day, never explaining what we were leaving or what we were going to. She just liked to keep on moving, to keep the world at her back. It was dark, but I could hear the steady breathing of my little sister, asleep on the seat beside me. As my eyes adjusted, I could even make out her form, huddled beneath a blanket, her head against a cushion. The windows were misted with condensation, and it was disorientating, as if the world had ended while we were asleep. When I smeared my hand across the glass, I couldn't see any lights outside, and I thought it was strange not to hear passing cars, people, or traffic. Sometimes when you sleep next to a motorway, it sounds like the sea. I couldn't remember getting into the car. Confused, I looked at the figure sitting in the front seat. Our mother was sitting with both hands on the wheel, staring straight ahead at the misted windscreen. I could only see the back of her head, her knotted, dark hair. But I knew from her posture that she was awake. The engine was running. I tried to open my door, but it was locked. Mother didn't turn at the sound of my movement, but I heard her applying pressure to the accelerator, causing the engine to rumble louder. My head was sluggish, slow-moving, and I'd never felt more tired. I tried the door again, but it still wouldn't open. Sitting forward, I realized I was strapped into my seatbelt. Pulling the blanket off my sister, I saw that she was too. The engine rumbled a little louder, and I could taste the fumes in the back of my throat. I unfastened my belt and crawled across the gear stick into the front, trying to push up the lock on the passenger side door. My mother reached an arm across and pressed my body back into the seat, her forearm against my neck. When I resisted, she gripped me clumsily by the face, fingernails piercing my cheeks, dragging across them. I pushed up the lock, pulled the handle and kicked open the door, pulling free and falling out onto the garage floor, coughing and holding my face. I looked back at my mother, but she just resumed her position, staring straight ahead, hands on the wheel. I got up, walked round the car and opened the door on my sister's side. She was murmuring, dazed and confused, but she could stand. I held the blanket around her as I opened the garage door, and we staggered back towards the house where we were staying, both coughing, breathing the air. When we reached the door, I heard the horn sound 3 short bursts in quick succession. Our mother, beating the steering wheel with both hands. Chapter 2.
Try not to talk, said Pars.
He was standing by the window, looking out at a steel-grey sky.
You're in St. Mary's. We just can't seem to keep you out. Your jaw's broken in two places. And as for your teeth, let's just say you should have smiled more when you had a chance. Do you remember what happened?
I started to answer and felt a shockwave of pain from my jaw. When I looked at Pars again, I could feel my eyes streaming.
I said, don't talk.
He turned at the sound of my distress.
You never could follow orders, though, eh? You were causing more damage to your jaw while you were out, so it's been wired shut. Your diet might be even more liquid than usual for a little bit.
He gave me his shark smile.
Don't worry, he said. I told them you're a former drug addict. The painkillers could jeopardize your sobriety.
I was blinking the sweat out of my eyes, but when I tried to raise a hand to my brow, it wouldn't move. I looked down, starting to panic. Both arms were restrained. I tried to kick out my legs beneath the sheets, but they were held fast as well. Straining, I moved all my limbs at once, wincing when I tensed my jaw in the process. I gave up, panting and sweating, trying not to move my mouth.
Needless to say, you're under arrest. You do not have to say anything, but it may harm your defense if you do not mention when questioned something which you later rely on in court. Anything you do say may be given in evidence. Do you understand?
I could hear myself panting for breath.
I'll take that as a yes. In a moment, I'll unfasten your right hand so you can write a detailed confession about what's gone on here. And just to be completely unambiguous, I'd like you to explain why 10 grand in cash and a counterfeit passport with your picture in it was found amongst Luisa Yankovsky's possessions. She's dead, by the way. So try not to leave anything out. You're going to jail no matter what. In fact, I hear Strangeways have got an opening.
I looked up at him, and he nodded.
Wick's ex-cellmate, your pal Adam, took the ski jump yesterday. That's what they call it when a guy hangs himself with his bedsheets. See, there's not enough room to do it with the ceiling, so they wrap it round the bars, tie it to their neck, and then just lean forward as far as they can. Just a little tip, if it all gets too much for you in there.
I looked from Pars to the window.
If I could have broken a chair against it and walked through, I would have.
He saw this and nodded, not unsympathetically.
You tried, son. At least you can say that. Try to think of the world as hell. Tell yourself the poor fucker got out early for good behaviour.
He searched inside his jacket pocket for a notepad and pen, dropping them onto the bed. Then he came towards me and unfastened the restraint on my right arm so I could write. I picked up the pen and tried to stab him in the face, but he stepped back, watching me swipe at the air. I could hear my breath catching and started to rock the bed, shifted my weight from side to side, trying to turn it over. Pars just watched, waiting until I'd exhausted myself. Then he rested a hand on mine, pulling me into a hug. I looked up at him, and he crushed my fingers, using his free hand to grip my jaw. And then someone, somewhere, was screaming. He held on, kneading the broken joints between bony fingers, and I could feel goosebumps and sweat breaking out all over my body. Finally, something broke loose, and Pars stepped back, disgusted, looking down at the bed, the wet patch spreading across the sheets. He bent, collecting the notepad and pen that had fallen to the floor, and placed them beside me. There was just the ringing in my ears, the pulse slamming through my veins. An hour, he said, straightening his shirt. Otherwise, we'll have another little chinwag. When he left the room, I waited a minute, considering my options. After trying to unfasten the restraint on my left hand, I gave up. I picked up the pad, seeing that Pars had already made notes on it himself. The broad outline of the case, brief summaries of what had happened to the major players. I didn't immediately recall what had occurred on the roof until I came to a line with the words, Constable Naomi Black. They were crossed through. I began with the events of Saturday night, and the conclusion I'd arrived at. That Martin Wick had been sleeping with Maggie Moore all those years ago. That he'd fathered an illegitimate child who Frank Moore had unwittingly raised as his own. I wrote that Frank had discovered the betrayal, the chlamydia, and become a violent, bullying presence in his own home. I still felt certain that he was innocent of their murder. He'd spent the next few years trying to maim the man he believed to be responsible, after all. I wrote about Kevin Blake framing Martin Wick at the time, compelling him to sign a confession he barely understood, then reinforcing his version of events with planted evidence, a best-selling book. I wrote that Lizzie Moore had been alive all these years and had provided Wick with an alibi proving a police cover-up. As a consequence, Kevin Blake had come to this very hospital and murdered Wick to prevent him going public. I knew that was the least of it. And I wrote my own story, too. That I'd secured an expensively produced counterfeit passport, spent years withdrawing untraceable small amounts of cash from my account, prepared a go-bag with the intention of abandoning the investigation and escaping the spectre of Zane Carver. I wrote that Louisa Yankovsky had taken it from me, that she'd blackmailed me and compromised the case. I wrote right up to the events of the roof. To Naomi's useless, senseless death, and the unknown man in the balaclava who'd saved my life. Every lie told, and law broken. By the time Pars returned, took the notepad from the bed and sat in the corner to read, the wet patch on the bed had grown cold, and I was starting to shiver. He didn't look at me as he read, but I could see his surprise at my candor. "I don't understand," he said. "If you weren't in on it with Yankovsky, why didn't you just give her the phone that night it was in your possession? Why didn't you destroy it?" I held up my hand for the notepad. "Esther's life," I wrote. "Just think," said Pars. "You could have been all the way out of it by now. We were wondering how you'd managed to kill Yankovsky and dispose of the gun. Did you recognize this balaclava man?" I shook my head. "Frank Moore and Kevin Blake were both in police custody," he mused. "And I've already checked in on the surveillance detail at Carver's place. He was at home with the wife and kid. Seems like you've got yourself a guardian angel." I wasn't so sure. "It doesn't mean much, but I'm glad to know you weren't directly involved in the conspiracy." He met my eyes and gave a nod. "Now, I've got some good news and some bad news. The bad news is there's no way I can protect you from all this. It'll be ugly for us. A former detective inspector framing an innocent man, Frank Moore torturing him in prison, so Chase wants a clean sweep. It's very likely that you'll at least start out in the main population at Strangeways. We can't be seen to be giving preferential treatment. Once oriented, they'll segregate you at the first sign of violence. My advice? Start a fight early on, with the smallest guy you can see." I didn't move. "There is one ray of light, though. The good news is, it looks like I'll be promoted. Chief Superintendent Chase and I came to an agreement on the events surrounding Tessa Klein's death last night. With no new evidence to the contrary, we're both content to call it a suicide. Call off the active search for her remains." Pars drifted back to the window, blending in with the grey sky outside. He cast no shadow, and there were moments when I thought he wasn't real. But none of this was happening. Unfortunately, the pain in my jaw proved otherwise. "The teeth you gave me have been incinerated," he said. "You were right.
Chase sent Klein undercover to get close to Carver. It seems that she wanted his head on a plate to pave the way for her ascension. It seems she underestimated him. Our working theory is that Carver and Klein had an affair. He convinced her it was the real thing, and she was safe to leave her job. After that, he had her done in. He turned, saw the look on my face.
Oh, don't worry. We're not giving up on him. In fact, that's why Constable Black was assigned to you in the first place. A shadow who could pick up anything and everything about your relationship with Carver before we put her on his case full time.
Pars walked to the door and paused before leaving. You've got one thing wrong in your notes there. It was young Esther who Yankovsky shot on the roof. Black had just lent the girl her jacket because it was so cold. She got off with a blow to the back of the head. Nasty concussion. But she'll be fine. After all this, I think she's ready to have a crack at Carver, don't you? So good work, son. In a roundabout way, you did everything we expected of you.
When he told me that Naomi was alive, I'd never felt anything like it. I set my jaw as firmly as I could and spoke through the wire.
Turn around.
Pars looked amused when he did, seeing the sweat spike out from my skin, my fists gripping the bedsheets.
Send her in against Carver, and I'll bury you.
If looks could kill, I might take that threat seriously. As it is, you're in no position. You'll be transferred to Strangeways in a couple of days. Let me know how crushed glass tastes as a condiment, eh?
How many teeth in the human body?
I spat.
I couldn't move my mouth properly, and swallowing was painful. Saliva bubbled at my lips. Pars leaned in closer to hear.
Excuse me?
How many teeth in the human body?
Less in yours than most.
Did you count Klein's before you buried them? Were you paying attention? Because you might be a few short.
Calmly, Pars went to the door and opened it. I thought he might be leaving, but he just checked there was no one outside. Then he closed it and came towards me, gripping my jaw again.
I don't believe you,
he hissed into my ear. When I laughed, I sounded insane, and I leaned into his hand, forcing more pressure onto my jaw, looking him dead in the eye, bubbling the blood spit on my lips until it flecked against him. He let go and took a step back, frowning, appalled. He took a handkerchief from his pocket and wiped his face, then his hands.
I'll have your car taken apart, he said. I'll rip up your flat. You won't find a thing. So what the fuck do you want?
Take this shit off me.
He rubbed his red eyes with his knuckles, then unfastened the restraint on my left arm, watching me closely.
I want the bag back.
No can do.
Then expect Charlie Sloan to get some interesting mail.
You're bluffing, he said.
I just looked at him and he shrugged.
I'll need to discuss it with Chase, he said, not looking at me. Anything else?
Naomi goes nowhere near Carver.
He tried to gauge the look on my face, but my eyes were tearing, bloodshot, and I had red saliva dripping down my chin. My jaw was painfully swollen, broken in two places and wired shut. It was probably hard to get a read on me.
I'll see what I can do. I suppose you know that as a free man, you'll be in even more trouble. Carver's been waiting for this lad. He'll have your guts for garters. Fucking literally.
That hit a nerve. And then the look must have passed across my face because he went on, seizing the opportunity.
Why don't we explore some other arrangement here? You've got the teeth. The way I see it, that's leverage. We could have you promoted, say, posted to some quiet backwater, safe and sound.
I thought about Tessa Klein,
A young woman manipulated by both sides and murdered without anyone willing to take responsibility. It could so easily have been me. And I wondered, morbidly, what had happened to her, where her body was, and what her final moments had been like. In a few hours, I might find out firsthand. I should have cared more, I thought, shaking my head. I should have done something when it could have made a difference.
Send someone else with the bag. I don't want to see you again.
Fine, said Pars. There won't be a lot of upsides in your future, so have it your way. I'm sure I'll be seeing you again, though, son. Missing persons posters, autopsy reports, cremations.
With that, he seemed to just fade out of the room like smoke. Once he was gone, a thought occurred to me. I pulled the restraints loose from my ankles, climbing out of bed, going unsteadily to the door. There was no police guard or firearms officer posted outside. I walked to the end of the corridor, ignoring the passing cleaner, and looked round the corner. Pars was talking to Chase, neither of them seeming particularly upset. Had I actually been arrested? Or were they just trying to flush out whatever it was I might know before working on how best to handle me? I had evidence proving they'd sent a young woman into an impossible situation, got her killed, and allowed the world to think she'd committed suicide for the sake of their own careers. They must have thought they were buying me cheap. I walked back in the direction of my room and found a nurse. She made a sympathetic face.
Painkillers?
Give me everything you've got, I said, through the wire.
Chapter 3. The painkillers made my jaw more bearable, and I slept in fits and starts, snapping suddenly awake at passing sounds, people who weren't there. My mind kept circling back to Lizzie Moore, Esther, as she'd remade herself. She had two very different lives, and been stood right at the edge of a brand new one. She'd come so close to overcoming a lifetime of powerful, negative forces, only to be crushed to death by them at the last second. There was probably a lesson in there for me, but I'd always been a slow learner. I was watching the day end, the room colouring like a bruise, when there was a knock at the door. A lean, serious young man entered, and part of me wondered if he was working for Carver. Instead, he handed me the bag that Yankovsky had taken from my flat and asked me to sign for it. Afterwards, looking through the contents, I had to laugh at his disinterest. How could he know he was saving my life? I knew I couldn't leave until it was dark out, and I was staring at the window, watching the colour drain out of the sky, wondering where I'd go next, when the door opened. To my surprise, Sooty entered the room. He was wearing a nightgown, stretched see-through across his frame, with bandages around his arms. The ones around his head had been removed, and I could see the livid burns on both sides of his face. His hair had been singed right back to his skull, and he had no eyebrows.
"You're awake," I said, through the wire.
It was easier to speak now, but my voice sounded blunt and uninflected.
"Nah, pal, you've died and gone to heaven. I put in a good word with the big man, and we're going to be roommates for eternity." I resisted a smile. "How are you feeling, Soots?" "I wish you'd never come to the temple and drag me back here. But at least I've still got me looks. How about you? Looks like everything worked out great." He was being ironic, and it hurt when I laughed. "Well done for landing on Blake," he said.
"That's what Wick was telling you on Saturday night.
Said he'd been framed, that he couldn't produce Lizzie Moore to prove it. When he said she was visiting the hospital that night, I was interested to see what happened."
"You'd have saved me some trouble if you just said so. I showed him that picture of himself in the paper," he said. "The one that had been taken on the ward. He told me his daughter had managed to get in because she was bribing cops. I didn't know if you were one of them. I didn't know if I could trust you."
She survived all that. For what?
The truth, he said simply. I think I've had all the truth I can take. It's like a fucking suitcase full of old notes. It's not worth anything.
Sooty looked at me.
I was first on the scene when Wick was arrested, you know.
Yeah, I've seen the tape.
He nodded. It was quite a sight. Guy passed out, foaming at the mouth, covered in blood. I had to get him up and help him out. It was only later, when they worked out who all that blood belonged to, and I started to feel sick.
Three kids.
He trailed off, producing a small bottle of alcoholic hand wash, cracking it open and smearing the contents on his skin.
Now, I find myself using this stuff whenever I think about it.
He avoided my eyes, and I couldn't tell if he was blushing or if it was a result of the burns. But it was as open as he'd ever been with me.
That blood was on Wick's hands too.
You got it off. You'll find your own way, he said with a nod. You always have. He opened the door and stepped through it.
Take it easy, Peter,
I called after him, as loud as I could manage.
Yeah, eight. I'll catch you later.
Chapter 4 I dressed and left the hospital without speaking to anyone. The painkillers were keeping me upright, but nothing could prepare me for my own reflection on the way out. I stopped, double-taking at the bruised, swollen face in the glass. I was only a short walk away from St. Mary's to my flat, but I flagged down a cab. The first one drove off as I leaned into the passenger side window. When a second one stopped, I didn't give him the choice, climbing immediately into the back, holding the bag close to my body. I dug around inside it, finding the letter I tried to write to my sister. I looked over it one final time, and then ripped it up, as small as it would go, littering the pieces out the window. Some things aren't meant to be. I got out two streets from my building and paid in cash. Once inside, I took the stepladder down from the landing and carried it into my flat, standing it beneath the loose light fitting. Then I climbed up, restoring the bag to its rightful place. It had occurred to me when I saw my own reflection that I couldn't go anywhere until the swelling in my face subsided. I no longer resembled the man in the passport. While I was up there, I felt around for the envelope in which I'd hidden three of Tessa Klein's teeth. Watching the hours pass in St. Mary's, I'd written a full account of what I knew of her story. The complicity of Pars and Chase. Now, I wrote Charlie Sloane's name onto the envelope, his address at the Mail, then stuffed it all inside the bag. As I closed the ladder and placed it against the wall, there was a gentle knock at the door. I couldn't remember if I'd closed the street entrance behind me. And when I tried to ask who it was, my voice came out as an inarticulate drone.
Sorry, said the man on the other side.
I opened it to Robbie, my new neighbour. He took a step back when he saw me, afraid for a second, before squinting and saying,
Aidan! Jesus, mate, what happened?
Car accident, I mumbled through the wire. Looks worse than it is. As I spoke, I realised that was a lie. It was much worse than it looked.
Right, said Robbie, forgetting for a second why he'd come over. I just wanted to say sorry about the other night.
I shook my head. The bad nights had been stacking up recently, and I couldn't immediately place what he was referring to.
The woman I let in. A blonde number in the red dress.
Louise Yankovsky. I nodded, and he went on.
I'd been out two or three times and seen her waiting in the cold. I asked if I could help her, and she said she was meeting you. Would I mind if she waited inside?
I didn't mean to come between you and your lady friend. I mean, your partner, whatever she is.
Neither of those things, I said.
Don't worry.
Right, he said, wincing again at my face. I've learnt me lesson, though. A girl buzzed my flat for you earlier when there was no answer at yours.
He searched his pockets and found the note.
I could see a phone number but focused on the name. Anne, he said. I accepted the note carefully, holding it with both hands. When I looked up, I saw that he was waiting for some kind of response. My sister, I said. Chapter 5. My sister hadn't left her address, but I knew where she lived. A large, shared house south of the city, in Fallowfield. I'd driven past a few times, and even stood outside it. Once getting as far as the front door, before my reflection in the glass, the look on my face had scared me away. At least now I was unrecognizable. I drove carefully, because I knew I wasn't thinking straight. Being pulled over in my condition could be bad, but there hadn't seemed much point in calling ahead and trying to make myself understood over the phone. The painkillers wouldn't show up on a breathalyzer, and anyway, from the demented ache in my jaw, it seemed like they were already wearing off. I pulled up to the curb, cut the engine and climbed out, walking towards the house without hesitation. I'd been careful to keep an eye on the rearview mirror for the matte black Mercedes that had been appearing, on and off, over the last few days. I still didn't know who the man in the stairwell had been, my guardian angel. But I knew I didn't want him here. I knocked on the door and waited. This would be my last stop before leaving. Afterwards, I'd go to another city, an anonymous hotel, where I'd prescribe myself generous doses of scotch and lie low until the swelling in my jaw subsided. I'd develop a crick in my neck from looking over my shoulder, book the longest flight to the hottest country I could find, then pray I cleared security. I thought about Thailand, Cuba, Mexico, all the places a man might disappear. The light came on, interrupting my thoughts. Then the door opened and she was there. Her hair was darker than I remembered it, but her eyes hadn't changed. She had a phone to her ear, and there'd been a half-smile on her face from the conversation I'd interrupted. It fell away, first in shock at my appearance, then in shock at my identity. "I'll call you back," she said, to the person on the other end. I recognized her voice from somewhere, and realized it must remind me of my own. There was a rush of feeling, pressing up through my chest, into my head, past that even, and I felt myself swaying in the doorway. Anne laughed and touched my arm, as if to check I was real.
"Aidan?"
I nodded.
"Will you come in?"
She started to lead the way, and then turned back to me, hesitating for a second before crushing me into a hug. Slowly, I lifted my arms and put them around her, and we stood there like that for a full minute. The front room was comfortably cluttered. Books, records, laptops and blankets, one of which she'd been sitting beneath on the sofa. We both sat and she looked closely at my face.
"Were you in a fight?"
"Believe it or not, I won. My jaw's wired shut." "I wish I could say you're looking well." "I probably should have texted."
"No, you probably should have come round. Probably years ago." "I don't even know what to say. Do we have time? I mean, do you?"
I nodded, wondering if it was a lie.
"How long's it been?"
22 years, I said, and she nodded gravely. 9 months, 3 weeks, 4 days, 6 hours. She laughed at that.
"Sometimes I thought I'd made you up," she said, shaking her head. "Like, remembered it all wrong, you know? Sometimes it seems like none of it actually happened."
"It happened," I said.
"I've got so many questions. Where did you go to when I left the Oaks? I always wondered."
"Some foster homes, here and there."
"But not with a family?"
"I was too old," I said, with an honest but I knew senseless feeling of shame. I felt myself blushing. And I had anger problems. Never really found the right people. I hadn't meant to sound so bleak and Anne took it seriously, holding my head, lifting it so we were looking at each other in the eyes.
"You found your people now," she said.
I nodded, and she nodded back, letting go of me.
"What brought you here? I mean, why now?"
"You came around," I said. By now the painkillers were plainly wearing off, and I was finding it more difficult to speak.
"I wondered if it was important."
"Well, I had a call from social services," she said.
I closed my eyes and she went on.
"I think you had the same one."
I nodded, in a way that acknowledged I hadn't handled it well.
"She's not good, Aidan."
"She never was," I said, opening my eyes.
"No," said Anne. "Bad month for me, though. Eliza, my adopted mother, died last week. I suppose that's why I'd agreed to go and see Christine. Maybe that's why I finally worked up the courage to go and see you. You're my only real family now."
Her voice trembled, and I had to look away for a second.
"How did you know where to find me?"
"The social worker," she said. "Sandra? She said Christine gave her your address." "Had the two of you been in touch?"
I frowned, shook my head, wondering why our mother had been keeping tabs on me. After all this time, I couldn't quite believe it was maternal instinct.
"I thought, well, I wondered if you might come to see her with me."
I thought of the bag hidden in my ceiling, the imagined hotel room, and the minibar I'd set my heart on draining dry. The ticking clock that meant I couldn't possibly agree to this. Then I looked at my little sister and nodded.
"When do we leave?" I said.
Chapter 6. I took the spare room, hitting the mattress like I'd been shot in the head. I'd seen it happen twice in the last 24 hours, and it was the last thought that crossed my mind before closing my eyes. When I woke up in the morning, one of my cuts had opened, sticking my face to the sheets. I stripped the bed and went downstairs to find the washing machine. Instead, I found my sister asleep at the kitchen table, her head resting on her forearms, laptop closed in front of her. She'd made herself a cup of tea, but it was still on the counter with a bag inside. The mug was cold to the touch, and I wondered how long she'd been down here. I went through to the utility room, loading the sheets into the machine and catching my face in the mirror. The swelling hadn't gone down, so much as shifted in its sleep. I found a plastic bottle of paracetamol and a blister pack of ibuprofen, taking four of each before pocketing the rest. When I returned to the kitchen, Anne was awake, looking at the closed laptop.
"I bled on your sheets," I said, testing my mouth. It sounded like I was speaking through gritted teeth.
When Anne turned, I could see that some of the excitement in meeting her long-lost brother had abated. Now, I was just a strange man in her house one morning.
"You don't need to do that."
I came around the table and sat opposite her so she wouldn't have to twist around.
"I like to destroy the evidence as I go."
She didn't say anything.
"Is something wrong?"
"Do you know how I knew you were a policeman?" she said.
I nodded, realizing what she might be reading.
"You saw my name and face in the paper. You sent a letter to the station once."
"I always wondered if you got it."
"I've still got it," I said.
"Why didn't you reply to me?"
"I was in trouble," I said, honestly, and ashamed.
Her eyes went to the closed laptop.
"The story was true then?"
"Some of it," I said.
"It was stealing drugs from evidence?"
I nodded.
"Were you fired?"
"Not then."
"But now?"
I nodded.
"And what about the drugs?"
"Not anymore," I said,
hoping she hadn't heard the rattle of paracetamol as I crossed the room.
"You're still in trouble, aren't you?"
"I never really left," I said.
I hated the sound of my voice, its abruptness and lack of emotion.
"I haven't always done the right thing."
I thought about Lizzie Moore, Tessa Klein, Naomi,
Sometimes I haven't even tried.
Okay.
She moved her laptop to one side and looked me in the eyes.
So what about now?
Chapter 7. We took my car. I drove and she rooted through the discarded CDs in the glove compartment, trying to find one that fit the occasion. We listened to Carrie and Lowell, then Hats by the Blue Nile. Martha Wainwright. When Martha started to sing Factory, my sister hummed slightly along, not even realizing she was doing it. Then she glanced at me and trailed off. We were merging onto the M25 when I caught a sight of a matte black Mercedes three cars back and felt a chill, wondering what I was getting her into.
All these roads feel so familiar, she said, breaking into my thoughts long after the final track had played. Remember how much we used to drive? I used to think every car on the road was a kind of moving house. I thought they all had families in them like ours, and they all slept in service stations.
We glanced at each other for a second.
For ages after, I kept waking up in the middle of the night, expecting to be taken out to a car, and in the mornings, I always expected to wake up in new places. Do you ever think about it?
I nodded. I stole cars when I was younger. She shifted, so she was facing me, but I kept my eyes on the road.
And you think it was because...
Yeah, I said. I never really went anywhere. I'd just break in and then sleep in the back. As I spoke, I realized I'd never shared this with anyone, and saying it out loud felt like something unlocking inside me. It felt like being cured of a terminal illness.
Do you remember when we lived in the offices?
Our mother had found the building one night while driving. A construction crew had destroyed the staircase in the lobby to discourage vagrants from sleeping there. She'd simply fed me through a high window, and I'd unlocked a fire exit from the inside.
You had your own desk, I said.
Anne laughed.
You said I was in charge. You made me sick, spinning me on that swivel chair.
I think you fired me for that.
You deserved it.
We drove on in silence, both smiling at the memory.
What I don't get is, we weren't so bad, were we? Like, why couldn't she...
No, I said. We weren't so bad.
After a minute, she turned in her seat, so she was staring straight ahead again.
Did you ever feel like you were a mistake? She said. Like we both were.
She glanced at me, saw me trying to answer with anything but the truth, and moved on.
Do you remember the man? The man who came to live with us sometimes?
I looked at her, feeling my eyes mist over, and nodded.
I think that's the only thing, she said, rubbing her arms.
She was wearing long sleeves, and it made me wonder if she still had the scars.
That's the only thing I'm really scared of.
He's dead, I said, cutting my eyes back to the road. I could feel her staring at me.
You're sure?
I was there.
She shifted so she could look away, out of the passenger side window, and we drove the rest of the way in silence. When I looked for the matte black Mercedes again, I couldn't see it. Chapter 8. We arrived ahead of schedule, after a 4-hour drive, pulling into the car park of the Royal Sussex County Hospital. My sister went to get a ticket while I waited in the car, looking up at the gleaming glass monolith in front of me, where our mother was recovering from an attempt on her own life. I lost time for a second, and jumped when Anne knocked on the window. We went inside and spoke to the woman on reception.
Are you next of kin?
My sister touched my hand and nodded.
I'm not finding a Christine Farrow, said the receptionist. Could she be under another name? Christine Waits? Anne offered.
The receptionist typed, then shook her head.
No.
We're meeting her social worker here, I said. Sandra Allen.